Hello, everyone. Thanks for joining me around the fire. Small towns can be found all across the globe. They sprung up in response to agricultural demand. Nowadays in the U.S., these villages are a natural remnant of our colonial past. While idyllic for those seeking peace and quiet, many of these communities hide a much more sinister energy. They seem to be a breeding ground for the mysterious. After all, I don't think it would be an exaggeration to say that small-town superstition is a phrase most people have heard before. You see, each of these isolated, unassuming communities hosts their own tapestry of the eerie and supernatural. Stories you won't find in books, lore you can't read about online. So I've gathered us here tonight to hear from the people who inhabit these places. The legends that plague their roads, the ghosts that haunted their homes, and the creatures that stalked their woods. I'm Aaron Sauerland, and this is Campfire Stories. Tonight, we're very excited to have Pat Adamek with us around the fire. Pat, you want to tell us about yourself?
Well, yeah. My name is Pat Adamek. I am an actor in Chicago, and I love ghost stories. I heard a lot of them when I was a child, and I think that I brought a particularly spooky one to share with you today.
Love that. I think it's rather fitting that this is our first episode of Campfire Stories, seeing as we share the same hometown.
Indeed, we do. Grew up not but a mile apart.
Do you want to tell us a little bit about Lake Villa?
Well, Lake Villa is your pretty stereotypical small town surrounded by cornfields in Illinois. It is pretty much as far north in Illinois as you can get before the Wisconsin border. So there's a lot of agriculture around, but there's also, in the last few years, been a lot of development of logistics sites, Amazon warehouses, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So you got a fair mix of industrial and rural mixed together. And then sprinkled all around are all the little subdivisions.
Oh, yeah.
And they have all those names that everybody probably has in all their small towns. Eagle's Nest subdivision. And
that's so true. How many Harvest Hills and neighborhoods like that are there in the United States? I couldn't even imagine.
And all of those have roads that are named after the farmers whose land they used to be built on. So all throughout Lake Villa, you can find your way. There's all kind of weird names. There are roads that intersect that have the same name because that's just how creative these farmers were, I guess. You drive through. It takes you 5 minutes. If you're not paying attention on the map, you just see the McDonald's and the strip mall and a couple of schools, and
yep,
you're back in the farm fields.
Yeah. Very accurate. I think with that, Pat, why don't you take us over to Lake Villa, Illinois, and tell us the story of Geldon Road.
So I'd like to start this story back at the very beginning.
Mm-hmm.
In the early 1920s, there was a successful farmer named Mr. Geldon. He had fought in World War I as a sniper and now owned a large swath of farmland across basically the middle of what is now Lake Villa.
Wow.
And he had a long dirt driveway that went from the main road all the way to his farmhouse. And that was known by the locals as Geldon Road because it went to Geldon Farm. And it was as remote of a place as you could get at that time. It was as far away from the town of Lake Villa while still being within its borders as you could get. There wasn't much in the way of civilization surrounding the farm, but it was connected to Chicago through the main kind of highway road that went from Milwaukee to Chicago. So it wasn't totally removed from society, but it was kind of Wild West off on its own.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of room to grow corn, so that's what these farmers did. They grew a lot of corn, and this guy was very successful, Mr. Geldin. Even up to the point of when the Great Depression struck, he had amassed enough of a security net for his family in the form of assets and cash, and most importantly, gold, that he had hoarded away in a secret location on his vast farmland.
Mm.
So his children, he had two sons, and in the middle, he had one daughter, three children altogether. And they hardly even noticed that there was a recession happening.
Wow.
They were spoiled by their father, given gifts and asked to do the minimal work around the farm that they could possibly get away with doing while keeping the farm going.
Mm-hmm.
I'll say the accommodations for them were very nice.
Right.
Relative to everyone else who lived around there. So they quickly became spoiled. And by the time that the oldest son was in his early 20s, he felt like he should be able to go out and spend the money of his portion of the estate before the economy entirely collapsed. He wanted to just go out and have a good time, rage while the world burned, as he saw it.
Wow.
He wanted to move to Chicago with his money and live the bachelor lifestyle down in Chicago. And of course, this information broke his mother's heart. And one day, the eldest son and Mr. Geldin had a big blowout fight. His father begged him not to go, telling him that he was a fool, he was making a huge mistake. Everything that could be said to one another that they wished that they could take back later, they said those things.
Mm-hmm.
Their mother sobbed and begged them to stop fighting. But the oldest son was determined to go, so he packed up his bags, stole a little bit of food out of the pantry, packed it in a bag, and then that night went out to where his father had buried the gold.
Oh, man.
And he takes what he thinks is his portion, and he leaves a note behind that says to his father that he could have ruined him. He could have taken the whole fortune right then and there and just left them and gone off to live his own life, but he didn't. And he promised his mother in that note that he would see her again soon. He just wanted to get what he deserved in his mind.
Mm.
So he took off and started living the bachelor lifestyle, chasing flapper girls around jazz clubs and drinking all night with the boys in the back room of a speakeasy, smoking cigars, the whole thing. In his mind, he says, I deserve this lifestyle, so a fortune is coming for me. I just have to keep going, and the fortune will materialize because that's my destiny. That's what I deserve in life. Well, the economy got a lot worse. The Great Depression got as bad as it was going to get, and he had spent all of his money. And he was now at the point where he was going to be evicted from his apartment. So he has a bright idea. And he goes to Al Capone's mob. And he asks for a loan. And in collateral, he puts up some gold that he knows where it's located on his father's farm.
Oh, yikes.
So the mob bosses think about it. And they say, okay, we'll bankroll you tonight. And of course, he goes and loses all the money gambling at one of the speakeasies.
Mm.
So he decides to duck out of the bar and sneak out and head home. But on his way out, he's confronted by two mobsters.
Oh, man.
One of the mobsters punches him in the stomach, knocks the wind out of him, and the other one puts a gag in his mouth and a bag over his head, and they throw him in the car, and they start driving. The ride seemed to go on forever. He doesn't know where they're taking him. And in his mind, he was thinking, if I could just tell them that I'm going to make good on it, that they'll let me go.
Mm-hmm.
So he's in the back. He's screaming into his gag, and the gangsters eventually pull over. They pull him out, remove his hood, remove his gag and his bindings, and he's surrounded by corn.
Oh, man.
On all sides, pitch black, can see all the stars, and all he can smell is corn and some light rain. And so he knows what this means. He's about to dig his own grave.
Yeah.
But as he looks around, he realizes he's on Sand Lake Road, about a mile from his father's. So he screams out, "Fellas, I can make good." But before he can even finish his thought, he's hit in the stomach. But this time with the butt of a shotgun. And he begs, "Just take me to my father's house. Just take me down the road. I'll get you more gold than what I owe you." So they drive till they get to the driveway, and they turn off the car. They turn off the lights, and it starts to rain. There's some fog starting to settle in, and the mobsters exit the car into the pitch black. And they walk down the driveway, their boots crunching gravel beneath their feet, and they're pushing the son toward his father's house with the shotgun pointed at his back with a trench coat over the gun so that way no one could see what they were holding.
Right.
It's now 3 a.m., and the son starts knocking on the door, and the youngest son comes and answers the door. He says, "Who's there?" And the elder son says, "It's me. Go get Ma and ask her to come talk to me real quick, but without Dad." The younger son has the chain lock on the door, and he opens it up as far as the chain will allow. But the eldest son pulls the door closed again because he doesn't want him to see. He's all beaten up and bloodied.
Oh, man.
He says, "Go get Mom. It's really important, and I need to speak to her right now." So the brother just silently walks away. And not a second later, the father comes to the door. And peering through the crack of the chain opening in the door, he doesn't even look his son in the eyes because he knows nothing good is going on. 3 a.m., come knocking at the door. And he says, "My son, I have nothing left to give you. I gave you every advantage, and I put you out into the world, and it's clear to me that you wasted it all. And now you've come back looking for more. Tell you and your friends you can sleep in the barn until the rain is over, but I want you gone by morning." And with that, he closed the door, and they heard the bolts lock. Without any question, the mobsters grabbed the eldest son and pulled him down the gravel driveway, leaving trail of his feet in the dirt. And he's just screaming, "Wait, wait, I know where the gold is. It's buried in the field. If you just let me take you there, you can have it all." And the leader of the mobsters says, "Take us to the spot." So he's limping now at this point, walking along the edge of the field until they get to a long strip of woods. It's pitch black, but he's trying to find the spot that he can remember finding before, between two elm trees. Eventually, he gets to a spot where there are no elm trees, but there is overturned dirt. And he assumes this must be the spot.
Mm-hmm.
My father must be planning to plant more corn here. So cut down the trees, overturn the field. But he's pretty sure that the gold is still buried in that same spot because he thinks it's too heavy for his father to have moved, and he wouldn't tell anyone else where it is. So he explains all that to the gangsters, and they toss him a shovel. They say, "Get to work." So he starts digging as fast as humanly possible, His arms are about to give out when he hears the distinct clank of shovel hitting plank of a wood box. So the son looks up to the gangsters from the hole and he says, "This box is bigger than the last time. My father must have put even more gold and loot down here.
Oh, wow.
I'm going to need more help for to pull it up." So the other gangsters get in, they start digging with their hands, throwing up clumps of dirt until eventually they reveal a 6-foot by 3-foot wood crate. And they hoist it out and it's incredibly heavy. They get it on the ground, they pry the top open, they throw the lid back. The son screams because inside the box is his mother.
Oh my God.
She had passed away only days after he had left, and because he hadn't spoken to the family since then, he didn't know that his mother had died. The gangsters are not very happy about this, and the son collapses over his mother's body, crying as he realizes what a fool he had been and the cost of all that he had done.
Wow.
And the lead gangster lights up another cigarette and says, "This seems like a fitting end." And he pulls the trigger. And the eldest son slumps into the casket, and they push him back into the hole that they had dug, put the dirt loosely back on top. And they said to themselves, "Well, we might as well get something for this monumental waste of time that we've just gone through."
Damn.
So they start to head back toward the farmhouse to see what valuables they can find inside. But Mr. Geldon heard the gunshot. And as he looked down, he saw the gangsters coming out from the corn.
Wow.
He started to open fire on them. And after firing a couple of pop shots at the gangsters, they realized that they were not going to be able to outfire this guy because he had the advantage of the higher ground and he was more trained than they were. So they just decided to ask him to come out or they would burn the house down. And after about a minute of no response, the lead gangster lit the house on fire and he shouted, "Come out and show us where the loot is buried." But there was no response. And he shouted again, "If you want to live, come out and show me where the gold is." But there was no response. Finally, they realized that there was no way that these people were going to get out of this house alive. So they just drove around the farm looking for whatever they could grab to make it worth their while. Mm. When they figured they had filled up the car with all that they could, any valuables that they could find, they drove away, the house burning down behind them.
Wow.
And as they sped down the gravel driveway, they hit a speed where if someone were to step out in front of them at that exact moment, they couldn't possibly stop. And for some reason, the driver had this intrusive thought. "I'm going too fast. If I had to slam on the brakes, if an animal walked out, we would crash." And just before he puts his foot down on the brake to start to slow down, out of the corner of his eye, he sees from the yard of the burning house a woman covered in soot, in a white dress, sprinting as fast as she can toward the road. But of course, it was too late. He couldn't stop. He hit the girl. The car comes to a screeching halt, leaving huge skid marks on the road. They got out of the car to assess the damage, and they found the dead girl's body. Wasting no time, they get back in the car and they drove out of there.
Wow.
Back then, there was a police station in Lake Villa, but it wasn't close to where the Geldon farm was. And it took some time to get investigators out on the scene. And when they finally did, they found the bodies of Mr. Geldon, his youngest son, and the middle daughter. Even though it was pretty clear from the tire marks, and the police had a pretty good idea that the gangsters were the ones who had set the house on fire, they had no way to prove it, that it was anybody in particular. They had no case. So, sadly, there was no justice for the murder of the Geldon family. But their bodies weren't the only things found in the rubble. Investigators also found a fireproof vault. Everything else had burned down around this vault, but it was in perfect condition. They eventually were able to pick the lock, and they found all the gold bars inside this fireproof vault, along with cash. The total equaled over $1 million.
Oh my God.
And the county took possession of these unclaimed assets because there was no one left alive to claim them. And they used that money to build roadways, paved roadways, from the main road that went from Milwaukee to Chicago out into the farmland area so that there would be a better emergency response time and it would be easier for the police to patrol these houses that were out in the middle of these farm fields. And as a gesture of goodwill toward the Geldin family for providing these funds, they named the main road that was paved over their burnt down house Geldin Road. And it is said that today, if you go to Geldin Road late at night and you are to drive recklessly fast down Geldin Road, so fast that if someone were to step out in front of your car at the last second, you wouldn't be able to stop before you hit them. If you drive that fast on a light rain night, or if there's any fog, you may see a woman in white step out of the woods and directly in front of your car. She will get hit, and you will feel the impact and hear your car come to a screeching halt. Only once you get out of the car, there's no one there. No damage to your car, aside from the tire tread being painted onto the road. The tread marks being the only evidence that anything had occurred there at all. But as you look closer at your own, you see hundreds of skid marks, weathered and fresh, all in the same spot and all ending at the exact same place. You think, well, there's that old scary story about Geldin Road and the conditions tonight are not great. That's probably all this is. I didn't really see anything. I just freaked myself out. You explain away everything. You get back in your car. And then you notice smoke. You smell smoke. And as you start to pull away, you look in your rearview mirror, thinking that you spotted where the fire is, only to see a man and his son ablaze in the middle of the street, and the silhouette of an ash-covered woman in white standing in front of them.
Wow, man. That is literally chilling. It's so visual, you know, especially knowing that area. And like you said, you know, like it's surrounded by farm fields, and Geldin Road is slightly hilly. You know, it dips up and down a lot, too.
Oh, yeah.
I was going to ask you if you've ever seen the woman in white.
I have not. And technically, my mom hasn't either, but she was in a car when she was in high school with some other people who wanted to test to see if the ghost was real. So they went down Geldin Road late at night, sped down the road, and they came to one of those little hill spots, and the tires slightly came off the ground, she says. And she was so freaked out by this that she closed her eyes and prayed that they would be okay. And when they came back down, the two people in the front were screaming, and they slammed the brakes and they came to a halt. And they said that they saw the woman in white. But my mom had her eyes closed, so she didn't see anything.
Wow.
But she would still tell us that story to freak us out around Halloween every year.
Well, thank you. Thank you for being with us tonight. And before you go, is there anything you're working on or anything of yours that you'd want to promote at all?
So it's a little early in the process for me to start plugging it, but I'll take my milk crate here and I'll stand on it for a second, and I will say I am planning on doing a short series on YouTube where I dive deeply into the machinations and feasibility of the movie of Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory.
Interesting.
Where I will grossly go into depth on things that no one cares about, but it ties a major conspiracy within the world of Willy Wonka together that I have been working on since I was a little kid watching Willy Wonka to now being an adult who's seen it just way too many times. And I'm not sure what I'm going to call it, so this is not a great plug, but my YouTube name is Pimp Daddy Masterfly, so you can find me at Pimp Daddy Masterfly on YouTube.
I love that. That's great. I'm super excited. I think, we talk about sinister stories on here, but I think we've all discussed Willy Wonka's true intentions.
And they are a lot darker than I think some people realize.
All right, and then finally, I like to wrap up every night with a charity shout-out. Is there a charity or organization you'd like to highlight or anything?
I do have one. It's called the Last Prisoner Project, and it is a marijuana offense expungement charity that helps people who could not afford to have a lawyer, helps them with the legal complications that all of this new policy and law around cannabis, especially with the Joe Biden forgiveness stuff that's going on right now. I think that they are way understaffed, way underfunded. They need as much help as they can get because they're really doing a great service helping people get lawyers who would otherwise be doing it on their own.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great cause.
Hell yeah.
Wow. Awesome. Well, thanks for joining us around the fire and sharing your scary story.
Thanks for having me. It was a very spooky time. I loved it.
This episode of Campfire Stories was produced by me, Aaron Sauerland, with music by Brandon C. Stanley. Be sure to follow us on Instagram at campfirestories_podcast to keep up with new episode drops and more exclusive content. Thank you.